Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm so glad that you are here with us this afternoon. My name is Jim Baratko, and I am the Director of Worship Arts here at the First Church in West Hartford, Connecticut. And I'm just happy to introduce the other other people that are on the panel with me here today. First of all, I'm going to introduce Susan DeSelms. Susan is the music director and organist of the United Parish in Brookline, Massachusetts, and a member of the UCCMA and past coordinator of the UCCMA conference held in Boston. She joined the United Parish staff in 2001 with degrees in organ performance and choral conducting from Boston University, Indiana University, and Birmingham Southern College, as well as a great deal of life experience in church music. Adam Waite is the Minister of Music at Denver, Colorado's historic Montview Boulevard Presbyterian Church. In addition to overseeing the church's broad musical and artistic programming, Adam also conducts Montview's Westminster Choir, an 80-voice mixed chorus that is the cornerstone of weekly worship. As a composer, arranger, his commissioned works have been performed by the Colorado Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, the Metropolis Symphony, and the folk supergroup, I'm With Her. Dr. Emmett G. Price III is an internationally recognized expert on Black music and culture, Afro-diasporic sacred and secular expressions, and Christian worship. He has spent much of the past few decades writing, lecturing, and conducting cutting-edge research on bridging the generational divide. A well-regarded scholar and educator, Dr. Price has the unique ability to capture the hearts and minds of the most diverse and versatile audiences with his compassionate sense of humor, his amicable intellect, and his quick wit. He is a noted print and broadcast media expert, as well as a widely sought-after keynote and motivational speaker. Also on the panel for today is Brandon Brown. Brandon is the current secretary of the United Church of Christ Musicians Association, and he is currently serving a church in Chicago and lives in Missouri. He will be happening with the Q&A portion of the session later on. And also representing the John P. Webster Library, which is housed here at my church, is Carla Grafton. She is the librarian of that library, and she's facilitating as the host of this call. I'd just like to mention a couple of logistic things for those who are with us. We're going to be having an interactive discussion for about 45 to 60 minutes. I'll be directing questions to the specific panelists. Any panelists can join in or comment on during the discussion. Attendees can enter questions via the Q&A feature at the bottom of your screen. If you look at the bottom of the screen, similarly to the chat feature, there is a Q&A section. So you may enter your questions in there at any time, and we'll reserve a period of time to answer those questions at the end of the discussion. This webinar is being recorded and will be available on the UCCMA YouTube channel following the live session. I'd personally like to thank the UCCMA for their sponsorship of this webinar, and also the John P. Webster Library for facilitating the Zoom session here today. And with that, I would like to open up the discussion with Dr. Price. Dr. Price, would you please start us off by sharing some of the background about spirituals?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me, Jim, and to the UCCMA and the John P. Webster Library. Thank you for hosting, as well as my colleagues here, Susan and Adam and Brandon. Certainly wonderful to be with you as well. The spirituals are the sonic expressions of a people who had experienced such trauma and tragedy, oppression and pain, that they leverage their voices in order to send coded messages And I'm going to come back and talk about the coded messages because I think that's important. But you're talking about a people who had no social mobility, no economic stature, no political opportunity to express themselves in a representative democracy, who had lost or had their agency stolen, whose embodied experiences were not seen as being human, and folks who were literally perceived as chattel. Even as we think about the constitution of this great nation, the constitution chose, and the founders of the nation and the writers, the authors of the constitution chose not to deal with the issue of slavery. So here are disenfranchised, ostracized people who had a faith, and in that faith declared that if they did not receive equity, justice, if they were not included in their day and age, then by and by, when the morning comes, that they will see their true eternal reward. And so the spirituals are the songs of a population of people. They are the songs that are both sacred and secular. There are many many songs within the repertoire that are not necessarily religious, but they are spiritual. And so this body of work, over time, has been used and sometimes appropriated, sometimes misappropriated, but in ways and shapes and forms that have been the esprit de corps of humanity. And so I would suggest that any form of American popular music has some legacy or some pedigree that comes from these spirituals, from the moans and the groans, the raw utteral expressions, and from these melodic, rhythmic, and harmonic notions of what it means to sing your freedom, even when you are not free. What does it mean to sing your own equality when you do not feel equal? And what does it mean to sing your own justice when you don't experience that?
Thank you. How were these spirituals used as a form of worship?
Well, Jim, I would define worship as engaging with God in ways that God makes available and makes possible. And so the very notion of the lives of these individuals who created this body of work was worship, particularly based on their faith. So the spirituals were not necessarily a repertoire that was used within a Sunday communal gathering. These songs were used almost to utilitarian. They were used in the functionality of their lives. So when it was time to flee, or when it was time for slaves to escape, they would sing a song like Wade in the Water, God's gonna trouble the water, right? When it was time for them to gather by the river, they would sing a song about gathering by the river. And that's what I mean about the coded and decoded messaging. Up until the 1960s, music historians, unfortunately and unkindly, wrote that slaves sang in order to keep happy and jovial. Well, these slaves never were happy, and they didn't sing in order to be happy. They sang in order to express their innermost desires, needs, cares, and concerns, and to communicate coded messages with one another. So when they sang Wade in the Water, that was a signal to the slaves down the road that they would be escaping that night. When they sang Follow the Drinking Gourd, which was a paraphrase of Follow the North Star, that was a message to tell them that they were going to escape by a certain route. When they sang Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child, that was a song that helped them to embody the fact that they were not alone in their own personal feelings, that collectively many of them felt as they were motherless, not just in terms of a mother, but in terms of their motherland and their home and their heritage. So these coded messages were utilitarian, and they were also worshipful because they were saying to God that we understand, God, that you are greater than we are. And we understand that we can bring our souls to you, our cares and our concerns to you. And in your time, not in our time, all things will be revealed.
So I've encountered some opinions about white churches using this music, and how some people think that that's not appropriate because it's cultural appropriation. What are your thoughts on, or what do you think we should be doing about that? Should white churches actually be able to use this music? Does it speak for us as well?
Yeah, Jim, I'm going to problematize your question just a tad bit, and I hope you don't find me flippant, but I don't know what a white church is. Right. I mean, you know, so I'm being funny on purpose, though, because I think the notion that when we categorize our churches based on human ethnicity, then we define God based on that human lens. And a white church would serve a white God and follow a white Jesus. And the challenge of that and the problem of that is that it codifies the spiritual plane within the limited purview of human lens, which means that if I'm not white, I don't belong to your church. And if I'm not white, I can't belong to your God. And if I'm not white, I can't follow your Jesus. So the problem of that nomenclature and the thinking that arises from that nomenclature, you know, is a fact that if here I'm going to use air quotes here, if black is the opposite of white, then, you know, can white people sing opposite songs, right? And here's the problem. Within the black space, within the black culture, and I mean Afro-diasporic culture, which is the cultural context of the African diaspora from the continent through the Caribbean, through Afro-Latinx communities, through South and Central America into the United States of America, we have never thought about us as in thems. We've always thought about the world as being full of human beings. And if we can, you know, connect and be a part of a fellowship, you know, a kingdom of God per se, then, you know, that's a wonderful thing. So when black people create, and you can look at the legacy of the black culture continue, when black people create, we don't create stuff just for black people. We create things to give to the world, to gift to the world. And here's what I mean. If you understood that when I sang, sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home, that it's not about the performance practice of that song, but it's actually about the text of the song, then for you to suggest that that's beautiful or a beautiful rendition means that you haven't heard what I sang. Because there's nothing beautiful about feeling like a motherless child a long way from home. That's actually a plea, a cry to be part of community, right? And so the problem, the unfortunate part of it is because we codify our churches based on this ethnic because white is not even an ethnicity. So based on this, division thing, then we create a sense that we're not able to hear each other, right? So the appropriation comes when one takes the musical product of the expressions of a people and devoid that from the content and the meaning of it. And this is the problem, right? So the problem is, if you're listening to what is being said and you don't respond to that, but you take what is being said and you utilize it and you reframe it, you rearticulate it, you repurpose it, then that's where the injury is, right? Because if you look at the history of Black people in the United States of America, all of our music, whether it's raw, whether it's guttural, whether it's soft, whether it's scintillational, whether it's, you know, whatever, is basically saying we want to be treated equally. We want to be, you know, treated with justice. We want to be treated with equality across all of the genres. And for people to just listen to the music and find it beautiful and not actually respond to the cries and the concerns and the laments within the music, that's where the problem is, right? And so I think that whether it's the you know, air quotes, white church, utilizing the music, I have no problem with that. I don't think Black people in general, and I don't speak for all Black people, by the way, but I don't think that the Black culture has a problem with that, because that music has been given as a gift. And as a final word, let me say this, and this is how you actually proof that thesis. There are many Black churches that don't spin spirituals anymore. Many Black churches don't program spirituals because that was utilitarian music for that day and age. And so, yes, some churches continue to do that to chronicle our legacy and our history, but we have new music that speaks to the needs and concerns of today, right? So the spiritual spoke to that day, you know, and when you look over the evolution of Black music, it's almost a 20-25 year cycle where 20-25 years later, this new thing pops up that speaks, you know, to the situation. And so even right now, the spirituals of the 21st century are dealing with Black Lives Matter and dealing with the murder of so many young people in multitude of genders and non-binary existence. These are the contemporary spirituals, right? So while folks are catching up and actually learning to listen to what was said hundreds of years ago, there are some folks actually writing spirituals today. There are some human beings who are lifting up their spiritual sounds today because they still have not been heard.
Thank you. So what some of the things that, how should we perform spirituals? Are there some guidelines that we can use to perform them appropriately?
Well, I think, I don't want to be the spirituals police, but I think that there's a sense of integrity and accountability and authenticity. I think that, see, the human condition, regardless of your ethnicity, regardless of your gender or non-binary expression, or not, regardless of, you know, how you define yourself, the human condition knows suffering. And as human beings, we all know suffering. And so that's not unique to one category of people or one group of people. So if you understand that song, the songs and the repertoire comes out of suffering, then I think that folks should tap into their own personal suffering as an authentic and integral expression of this body of work. But if we sing it, and let me go back to beauty, because I saw somebody type something in chat, and beauty is about aesthetics. So I'm not saying that there's no value in them in terms of an aesthetic praxis. I'm just saying that if I sang, sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Like, I'm not really singing that for applause. I'm singing that because the only way that I can process that pain internally is to externally articulate it and send it out. So if you find that to be a beautiful expression or a beautiful performance practice, or my voice is beautiful, I mean, that's where we got to work through that. But I'm not singing it because of the beauty. I'm singing actually because of the pain. And I know we've been socialized not to say, oh my God, that sounds so painful. But that would be the appropriate response, because that's actually what I was singing, my pain, right? And my trauma, right? So I think we have to be able to parse that out and work through that contextually, right? Because I think part of the practice that we have is that we tend to sing for beauty. We're looking for that gorgeous sound. We're looking for, those triads, working through. We're looking for those intervals to be perfect. Like, we don't want those minor seconds, right? Because it gives you the cluster sound and there's, right? We need to resolve that. And that's part of the Eurocentric model of, beauty and the aesthetic praxis. But pain doesn't necessarily come out in perfect thirds, right? And so I think that that's the challenge. I think everybody has permission, has an invitation to sing their pain. And if the spirituals is the repertoire that one uses for that, then I think that that's fine, but I don't think that, the appropriation of it should be devoid from the context from which it comes.
Right. So as just to kind of summarize this, then we should be looking at the emotion. We should be looking at the text, and we should be looking at the message. That is primary as far as our use of spirituals, not about whether this is a pretty song or if it's the right time of year or the right time of the Christian season or something like that. It's what is the message and how does that support our worship?
Yeah. But I think we do that with other genres of music. I mean, don't
absolutely.
We? So like, I guess what I'm suggesting is, why do we treat this body any different? I mean, when you take a Charles Wesley song, or you take, Johann Sebastian Bach song, or you take, take Handel, take whomever, you still program based on the context of it. Everybody writes their historical synopsis of where this song was created and why and all that kind of stuff. So it's the same thing, right? I mean, I don't think that we have to devoid. The problem is that in this nation, United States of America, and as well as in the world, we're having a problem with ownership, and we're having a problem, and I'll expand that to the notion of nationalism. We're having a problem of who belongs and who doesn't belong. And in dealing with the spirituals, you have to deal with the fact that that this population of people were told you don't belong. Like, so that has to be a part of the synopsis, historical synopsis. And many of our churches were not willing to go there. Like we're trying to do reconciliation without doing restoration, rehabilitation, and reparation. And you can't do one of that quartet of ours without doing the other three. And in some of our churches, as we're working through, how do I deal with race? How do I deal with ethnicity? How do I deal with some of these things that are human oriented, that human beings have created to divide and fracture ourselves? Many of our churches don't want to leverage the ministry of reconciliation, which God gave to the church, in order to do the hard work of doing those other three R's in order to get to that reconciled body. And so that becomes part of the challenge for us, that if you're going to sing spirituals, and I hope and pray that many people do, then you actually have to go back and do the healing work that creates a redemptive narrative of how we want to behold our Black brothers and sisters, and how we want to invite our Black brothers and sisters and find them equitable and give them justice, even within the body of faith.
Thank you, Doctor. Susan, one of the things I'd like to, in light of what Dr. Price has mentioned here, is I'd like to get a little bit of your background on how you've been using spirituals and what kind of processes you've been going through.
I grew up with spirituals. I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee, and my father's a church music director, and he was a huge proponent of spirituals. And so I grew up with them. My mother was a voice teacher. I remember hearing her teach, you know, the H.G. Burley spirituals in our living room. And it's just something I grew up with. I have always been really drawn to the kind of the authenticity of them, the deep emotional content that just you can't escape. I feel like they're music of the spirit and heart that is like, you know, when in doubt, find a spiritual, because it takes up all the clothes and just and presents the heart. And that's what I feel like is really why they are so useful for you know, those of us in our church music ministries. So that was the first part. What was the next part?
How did you use them in worship?
So we have always used them, and you know, and frequently, but as times have become more fraught with, you know, more violence against Black men on our TV that we can, you know, see, I think, and more sort of desire to create a just situation, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, these things have created a more and more fraught situation and more emotionally charged situation in which people don't quite know what to do. They feel inappropriate. They feel inappropriate singing these songs that may or may not hurt someone, you know, by us singing them. And I have always been, you know, very much of the mind of Dr. Price that like, this is music of the heart. And we, you know, and yes, we must acknowledge who they came from, but we also can't not let them go away, because they are still speaking to us. But it was still complicated, and it was still a problem. And when George Floyd was murdered on TV, it came to a head at our congregation. I programmed. We had we were online, and I played "Stand Still, Jordan." A really, I think it was pretty nice. It was an improvised arrangement of it that I did with a cellist and a violinist. And I thought it was, I thought it was perfect for the moment. And it was complicated. And I got some feedback that was, why wouldn't you choose the Mozart Requiem? Why would you choose such a tokenistic, a piece? This is appropriation, or, things like that. And it wasn't very many people. It was like probably just one, but even still, it was enough for me to kind of really get into my head and really try to figure out, like, this is obviously something's wrong here. Something's broken. And, I get that it's broken and I don't know how to fix it. And what do I do? How, why is it broken? And that's when the idea came to me about the royalties. I was diligently playing, paying CCLI, money to print hymns in my, I was like, wait a minute. This is a huge group of people who created this music that has been generating wealth in our music industry for so long. And none of that went to those people and their ancestors. So anyway, that's where it came from. And now, we use it, it feels a lot better. And I can give you more detail about that. I don't know how long you want me to talk, but yeah, it's been a lot. It's been good, better.
That's excellent. Yeah, you kind of melded a few things here that I wanted to make sure I got from you. So that's wonderful. Can you possibly go through a little bit about how did you work with your church leadership to bring this up to your congregation? How did that work?
Well, I was circling around a problem for a long time. And I was talking to people a lot about, just trying to figure it out for a very, for probably at least a year, frequently talking to people about it and just trying to figure it out. And when the idea finally came to me, I just started vetting it just with people. And then I didn't go directly to the council. I went directly to the people of color in my congregation and invited them to come over and just say, what do you think about this? Is this a good idea or is this terrible? Who am I offending if we try to do something like this? And what have I not thought of? And so that's how I did it. And then we, I got enough feedback and then I presented it to the church council and they were 100,000% behind it, which is, not a real thing, but it was a completely easy sell. And I took another few months to kind of organize myself around how to present it to the church in a way that they will fully grasp, like, first of all, the importance and the reason and why it needs to go on forever and not just like we can do this once. And because I really felt like in order for this to be an effective tool, that it has to be something we commit to forever, that this is not a one-time thing. So that's how it kind of unfolded.
So how did you introduce it to the congregation?
So I basically I wrote a sermon and we did us and I invited, well, okay. First of all, before I got to that point, I came upon Hamilton Garrett School, and that was kind of another, like, a God moment where I basically opened my email and there was this invitation to a block party and it was Hamilton Garrett. I'd never heard of them. And I read their biography or their mission statement. And I was like, well, okay, this is a school that is dedicated to keeping spirituals alive. And so I talked to their director and Jeremy Groover Flores. And she was like, she was, I think I really caught her off guard because I just kind of walked up to her and said, what do you think about? And she, anyway, so, a couple conversations later, and I think, we developed a partnership and I again vetted everything with her and then wrote a sermon and the service was filled with spirituals and Negro spirituals. I'm trying to do better about that. And sung by white people. Sorry, but of European descent, a very pale skinned European descent. And we did them authentically as well as we could. And I wrote a pledge for the congregation that we put in the bulletin every time we sing a spiritual, but this was the first time. And so it was there. And I read it out loud you know, it was a done deal. It was a done deal. I happen to have a neighbor that on the other side of the fence that is a reporter for WGBH. And I, like a few days before the event, I just said, "Hey, Craig." And I mean, I know this is, I don't normally like hit my neighbors up for like, you know, publicity, but I think this is a pretty good idea. I don't know. And so then he came and the tab ended up coming as well, the Brookline tab. And so, yeah.
Would you possibly be able to share the pledge that you had put in? That's one of the things I think maybe
I can. Like, would you like to see it right now? Can I share my screen, or do you want me to just cut and paste it into the chat?
Why don't you cut and paste it in the chat? I think that might be a little bit better for everyone to see it that way.
Okay. Oh, wait, I just have something cut. Okay.
While she's doing that, Adam, you and I share some experiences back in our history. I know before I was doing church music, or even while I was still doing church, I did a lot of playing with musicians outside of church. And I know you did some of that as well. How did that experience shape your thoughts about using spirituals and your approach to music?
Yeah, well, before I get in that, I'll just say thanks again, Jim, for inviting me to be a part of this. And Susan, it's really wonderful to hear your story. Susan and I kind of came to this idea at the same time, and I've been so curious. And I'm also tempted to yield the rest of my time to Dr. Price, because I could just sit here and listen to him talk all afternoon. Loved so much of what he had to say. So, my background, I didn't grow up conceiving of myself becoming a, you know, church musician. I didn't see that as my path. I was very much interested in music and did a lot of music. And when I decided that I wanted to be a professional musician, I saw myself going into jazz, composition, those arenas. I grew up in upstate New York, and I just, yeah, started to fall into, I don't know why, but some kind of understanding of jazz music and being able to hear it authentically. And I never gave it any thought, you know. There was hardly any, I mean, I understood the important people in the history of jazz, right, that made it be, but I never gave any thought to the way that music came to be, or the history behind it, or the meaning behind it. It was just something I lived in, and maybe intuitively felt that there needed be, I could tell when it was authentic and it was when it was inauthentic. I had that kind of intuition, you know, and I had some experiences along the way, which, you know, I reflect back on. I'm like, that was so gracious and so incredible. Like when I was at composition major at Carnegie Mellon, one of my Black professors was approached to music direct The Wiz, a equity production down at the Byam Theater in Pittsburgh, with Billy Porter directing, of all people. And he didn't want the gig because he was actually more interested in doing Bach. And he said, "Well, I've got this student. He doesn't look like he can play that kind of music, but he can play that kind of music." And to me, that was like the highest compliment. Like, that's awesome, you know. But again, not really, like, just, you know, when you're young, I don't know, you don't maybe give these things that much thought. And so at any rate, when I started to kind of come into church music, again, I didn't really give it much thought. It was already in my DNA, right? Under, you know, whether it be, yeah, like kind of like this R&B stuff that's in The Wiz, or if it's gospel, or if it's spirituals, it's like, well, of course that's going to be part of our musical worship experience, because that's part of me, just like a bunch of other music is part of me. But again, you know, not the best about seeing that, oh, I should give historical context to this. Like, I felt like we were being authentic because, again, that's something that, you know, I felt it's important to, you know, I can tell when something's not real, you know, it just doesn't come off the right way. And so I probably continued on that way, you know, for the next 15 years or so of my life. And Yeah, it was, you know, the kind of that great reckoning we all had around the time of the George Floyd murder. And I tell people this, you know, and that was awful, absolutely awful. But interestingly enough, what kind of got to me even more was that Amy Cooper video in Central Park. And maybe because the George Floyd thing made no sense, no sense whatsoever, but it did play into a couple of kind of preconceived and they're stereotypes for a reason. You know, it's like, it's a shame that, you know, it's like not that shocking to conceive of a police officer killing a black man, right? But it was, to me, it was like, wait, you know, here is a white person in New York City who's donating to all the same political campaigns that I'm donating to. And she's being racist right now. There's no way around it, right? And that started to kind of peel back some layers for me. It's like, well, if she did that, what's lurking, you know, under my skin, you know? What kind of latent racism things do I have hiding that I don't even know about, you know? And you start to think about these things. And so this is kind of a long-winded answer, Jim, to your question, but hopefully it's providing some context. So around that same time, our staff at Montview, our program staff, which would be the kind of the six folks, we have a co-pastorate executive director, myself, our Christian ed director, and our youth minister, we signed up for an anti-racism workshop through Next Church, which is affiliated with PCUSA. And I see Dr. Price is aware of them, and I'm sure a lot of some folks on the call are. And it was a really, really well-run and deep session. It was great. You know, it started with large groups, broke down to small groups, and then eventually you had these one-on-one coachings. And I was lucky enough to be paired up with this woman by the name of Leanne Hodges. And Leanne was a fantastic one-on-one coach for me. And, you know, we were talking about my history in music and the experiences I've had with Black musicians and all that, and some of the concerns I had, and trying to figure out, okay, what's the next step? And, you know, I was a little bit at a loss. And she went right there with like, well, how about reparations? And thought, well, reparations are, they're good. I'm for that, but isn't that something the government is supposed to do, you know? And she challenged me. She's like, well, why do you think it's the government's job to do reparations? You know, can't you do reparations? And so I sat with that and was like, well, I don't have well, yeah, she's right, you know? And then you start to think, well, what does that look like in the music program? And then I had, you know, of course, the same experience that Susan does. You know, we're all got these post-traumatic stress disorder from dealing with a different collection, royalty collection groups, you know, whether it be CCLI or you know, I think back to my dad. He owned a brew pub in upstate New York and used to complain about all the checks he had to write to ASCAP because he had a TV on in the corner, you know, and it's like, I realized, well, that's it, you know, we need to start charging a royalty for every single time we do a spiritual. And see, I actually, and I'm still playing around with this, not sure if you should draw a line right at spirituals. And that's something that I hope that congregations, as they consider this, think about. Because I think and I'm just, Jim, you jump in here any minute now, but I have a tendency to keep going, as you know. But I really feel a big problem we have in this country is that we are not real with our history. And it's time for us to get real with our history. And what better place to do that than through music, right? Music is the great communicator. Music can break down barriers like few other things can. Music can reach into our souls, into our hearts, and move us in ways that the spoken word can't and the written word can't. And a great place to get real with our history is in spirituals. And I'm just thinking back to what Dr. Price was saying before, as far as how spirituals are directly responsible for all that came after it. And to me, spirituals are, it's America. It's our folk music. You know, Dvorak had it right. Right. You know, when Dvorak was in New York City for those 10 years or whatever, New World Symphony, second movement. And, you know, up until that time, any American composer was just parroting Western European music. Right. And Dvorak said, you want to know what your American folk music is? It is the Negro spiritual. That's it. And so much of what's come after it, whether it be jazz, blues, gospel, whether it be the way American classical music has developed, whether it be rock and roll, you know, it's distinctly American, and it's grown out of, you can't have that without the spirituals. And so to me, the royalty program offers us a chance to become real with our history and to understand that this is in our DNA, right? And that just like, as Dr. Price was saying before, you would be painstaking in your performance practice about Bach and Handel, right? You should be even more painstakingly about your performance practice when it comes to spirituals, because this is our music, right? This is the American music. And I, you know, and I understand maybe it sounds a little, I hope I'm not being culturally appropriating by being a white person saying this is our music, but as an American, right, this is it. And so I'll leave it there, Jim, so you can jump in.
Right. So what did you do with that idea? I know you explained how you came up with the idea, but then you took it. What was your next step? Where did you go with that idea?
Right, right. Well, so at Montview, the church I'm luckily fortunate to serve here in Denver, you know, obviously we're going through COVID at this time. This would have been now early 2021. And simultaneous to that, we're also, we just going through a big construction project at the church. And I felt that it was, because there's a big educational component to this, I didn't want to start something at Montview while we were still all kind of scattered about. I felt like for this to get its maximum impact and maximum effectiveness, that it was important for us to be back in the sanctuary first. So Leanne, my coach, after the conclusion of the program and after this idea, she said, well, I want to introduce you to a few folks that I think might be interested in it. And Brian Henn, who I see is in the, as one of the participants signed up here. And hi, Brian, nice to know that you're on the call. Brian's great at the Center for Congregational Song. I did not know Brian prior to this, but Brian and I had some really great chats about it. And he really started to run with this idea of like, well, let's push this out nationally and let's see if we can develop a pilot program. And let's invite other congregations to participate and let's develop a discernment tool. And I have to give Brian a lot of the credit on that. You know, he and I had a lot of great conversations, and then he went and if you go to the Center for Congregational Songs website, that's all Brian's doing as far as trying to equip congregations to go through this discernment process. And I, you know, for folks that are on the call thinking about this, I cannot stress to you enough, I think it's really important to do the discerning work, because I think that, you know, it's more than just writing a check, right? And which is not to say that it's not important to put your money where your mouth is. I feel like it's very important to put your money where your mouth is. But if you also don't do that discernment and educational work, right, then you're kind of just, you know, you're keeping it at arm's length. And so that discernment work, and I think Brian did a fabulous job setting that website up, and I see he just put it into the chat. will help your congregation, you know, understand, okay, how do we want to do this? Because there's a lot of ways to do this, you know, and for us at Montview, you know, I decided, well, I'm not going to push this through as just a you know, okay, all of a sudden we're doing this. I realized, thanks to the great work that Brian did, I was like, well, this would really benefit our congregation to go through that discernment process too. So that's where we're at right now. We have begun the discernment process, and we'll see, you know, you check back in with us in about a year, and we'll see how it's playing out in our congregation. I think there's a lot of different directions we can go, you know, an idea is like, hey, every single choir practice, if we're doing a piece by whether it's a spiritual or if it's by a Black composer, or maybe it's a piece that's just clearly influenced by spirituals, we're collecting a royalty. I don't care if it's you know, a rehearsal, a warm-up, a concert, worship service, a royalty is happening. I would love it if that's the direction we go in, because I think, you know, obviously you can start to accumulate a good amount of money that way, but it also is that it's that constancy, that discipline of understanding, of wrapping your mind around this fact that this music is so important and we owe so much to it. You know, it's such a part of our musical DNA in this country.
Thank you, Adam. So I just want to, if we are running about 50 minutes into our session right now, and I'm looking to see if we can kind of wrap things up at about at the hour limit, so that we can have an opportunity for questions and answers. But before we do that, I'd like to see if there's two things that we can get to. The first one is, how do we know a song is a spiritual? Are there resources available to us that can kind of give us some of the background of where the spirituals, what kind of resources do people have? Can anybody answer that?
Well, there are plenty of resources. I mean, there are a number of anthologies and collections. I mean, going back to, you know, the early 20th century, when folks in the United States were collecting, you know, and notating what they were hearing. And then, you know, I saw in the chat, someone mentioned a book by Dr. Andre Thomas, a dear friend and a phenomenal colleague in this area. There are other scholars who have written in this area, in terms of collection, in terms of phenotypes, in terms of the distinction between a Negro spiritual, African-American spiritual, which is, you know, designated by time in many ways. And there are a number of organizations. One of our colleagues here in the chat just wrote, shared the National Association for the Study and Performance of African-American Music, which is a great organization that I've learned about recently. And there are a number of folks around who are doing this work. So there are tons of resources out here.
Thank you. What about, how do you go and research and find an organization that might be a good recipient of monies or reparations, or how we might want to be able to take this to the next step? Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
Go ahead, Susan.
Well, I would just say, look in your backyard. And you know, for us, there's obviously a million different ways you could go. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be a musical organization, but I think the investment in that musical, you know, those musical organizations is certainly a great way to go. But I think, again, looking in your backyard and developing a relationship, having a conversation with the leadership, and not just saying, hey, we want to do this and, you know, here's our money, but can we do this? And would you be willing to work with us on it and help us understand, you know, better the complexities of the issue, and how can we make this feel right and not like a charity project? Because really, we don't, that is, you know, the last thing in the world we want to do is create a charity project. and it's a debt and not a donation.
If I could piggyback onto Susan and echo a lot of what she just said, yeah, I totally agree with all of that. I think that I would encourage people to resist the urge to form like a grant committee, you know, that's like reviewing applications and stuff, because as Susan said, is a debt, and really lean into that, forming authentic relationships, right? And relationships with musicians or communities of color that will hold you accountable, right? So you're shifting that power structure. Don't necessarily use the money from the reparations as a way to continue on your white supremacy, right? So you've got to be thoughtful, but the opportunity is great, right? What a wonderful, I mean, isn't that what we want, right? Is to be an authentic relationship. So again, it takes a little more work, but I think it's worth it in the end.
I'll just share a quick story about, I have begun work in this area myself for my own congregation. And I reached out to the Artist Collective here in Hartford, Connecticut. They were ecstatic to be a part of this. And I look forward to it not only just as a form of reparations or money to say, but I'm looking forward to more being one of collaboration, where it's fostering youth groups and youth musicians. I'm looking for opportunities where I might be able to use them to foster their development and also to enrich my own congregation with the history and their experience that they're doing. So that's a little bit one of the things that I'm working personally on at this point. I just wanted to mention that the UCCMA is also looking to create, after this conference, a repository, if you will, of organizations that people have recognized that fit into this category and that people can use as a resource if they're finding in their particular area they're not finding the right organization that they want to be able to do it. These are going to be some organizations that people have already done in their experience. And so people can latch onto that and get some of that background as well.
Can I just add one little thing to what you said just about, so one thing when we started this, some of the first beautiful responses that I had from congregation members, and completely well-meaning, and I know that it was that when can the kids come and sing for us in church, and I was a little pushy about that, and I think that it is our first instinct to want to have those, to have that kind of relationship. And I think that's the kind of the last step, after that trust is built and after you've, shown that you're not looking for any repayment. This is not a two-way street. This is a one-way street, completely one way. And there are no strings attached, none at all. And, honestly, if there's a reason that, that the kids need to perform and need a place to do things, that's a different, a totally different thing. But, it's just something to be careful of. There's all these little minefields out there of ways that we accidentally diminish people. And I think it's good to, bounce ideas off, be careful. So that's it.
Great, thank you. Just to kind of wrap things up there, is there anything else that you didn't get a chance to bring up that you'd like to bring up at this point in time? Any last messages that you'd like to give before we go into our questions and answers?
I would love to say, first of all, to three of you, thank you for your courage and even engaging in this conversation, because I think that that's what, we often say the world needs love right now, and it certainly does. But in addition to love, the world needs courage right now. Mm-hmm. Courage to tell the truth, and courage to attempt to rectify historical and generational wrongs. And that's what I've experienced in this conversation. And thank all of you who are attending. I'm watching the chat, and I'm just loving the energy and the engagement in the chat. So thank all of you for being courageous listeners and participants as well.
One person asked what we actually did, and I guess we never got to that part. And I'll just say really quickly, the way we do it is when we sing a spiritual in worship, all the money that comes into the plate is our royalties that day. We put the pledge, and there is so people understand that we are, you know, which pieces are spirituals, and we put the and we let them know that's where the plate donations are going, and our missions giving fund matches those funds. And so far people have been really generous, and, you know, even in a time when people don't tend to carry cash, it's been really, a pretty easy sell. I had the same ideas as Adam did about, like, well, maybe every rehearsal, maybe every this, you know, but I got a little worried about fatiguing, people with an idea, and wanted to just, keep it simple and, make it an everybody kind of thing. That people could just, you know, all be a part of. And so that's how we did it. And the pledge, I think, is now in the chat. And I will be happy to share my sermon and all the resources that I've shared with other people, if you like them. I say, just go for it. that's how I do things. I just jump in. So.
Okay, anything else? All right, then why don't we go to the questions and answers? Here's the question that person has entered. I've searched for arrangers and composers of piano music for church who are people of color and can find very few. I want to support them. Can you give me some names or steer me some resources where I can find their music?
Yeah, there's a ton of stuff out there. I think, you know, one of the great scholars and arrangers of spirituals is Dr. Roland Carter. And I think his publication company is Marvell, Marvell. So you want to check out him. Dr. Andre Thomas, who I mentioned earlier, is another prolific writer and arranger. One of Dr. Andre Thomas's students, Dr. Marcus L.A. Garrett, there's another prolific writer and composer. And if you go to Marcus, M-A-R-Q-U-I-S, L.A. Garrett's website, he has just tons of information on his own personal website about arrangements and whatnot. Another one of Dr. Andre Thomas's student, Dr. Brandon Boyd, is another prolific writer who has his own series in here. And then I think we have to mention GIA Publications, although affiliated with the Catholic tradition, they have an African-American church music series that is edited by one of my mentors, Dr. James Abington. And there is a ton of publications there of African-American composers, octavos, things that your church choir can do. As a matter of fact, they have a quarterly magazine called GIA Quarterly, which I actually write and have been probably for almost a decade now, an African-American masterclass, which gives you background historical information about folks like Nathaniel Dead and some of the folks who are writing in contemporary times. So there's a ton of stuff out there. Hopefully this is helpful to you.
I would just want to, if it's all right, I'm the add-on guy right now, and there was a few things there Dr. Price said that I didn't know about, but just to also encourage all of us to do the work to find it, and to remember that our conservatories in this country are still Western European centric, right? So if you're going to conferences and just living in the, well, this is what's being programmed, this is what's being fed to me, this is, oh, we're all kind of up and we're loving this piece, loving that piece, whatever. No, you got to be pushing that boundary. You've got to be, and that's the great thing about the internet. I mean, we can find all this stuff, you know, just get on there, start to look. It's still not to the point where it's broadly accepted, widely accepted, because we still have so much Western European centralized music education in this country. So you gotta do the work.
Thank you. I noticed that there have been a lot of additions in the chat that with a lot of other resources in there. Again, this will be made available later on our UCCMA YouTube, and hopefully other chat will have a mechanism of capturing the chats and making that available as a resource on the UCCMA website as well. Nancy has asked, can you please speak to the relationship of spirituals to Psalms?
Sure. I mean, the Psalter clearly is both the song book and the prayer book of the Hebrew children as intoned in the Old Testament, and has been utilized within, you know, Judeo-Christian worship for centuries. And the Psalms in many ways are the definitive text that are used for many settings. But the spirituals were created by a people who, although they were perhaps perceived as being illiterate, had an oral tradition and a cultural continuum that in many ways extended their faith. And let me say this about some of the let me do it this way. White supremacist ideology is perpetuated via lies or untruths. And so part of the challenge is that we have been taught and trained, and I was a dean of the chapel and a professor at a prominent seminary. We've been taught and trained that it was the slave owners who taught Black people Christianity. And that is a historical lie, that a number of slaves would have interacted with Christianity even before they were human trafficked from the continent of Africa. Let's not forget that Jesus himself as a child touched the sand of Egypt. And the great writers, many call them the patriarchs of the faith, Augustine, Cyprian, you know, Tertullian wrote from Northern Africa. And so the notion that Christianity is a Eurocentric and or quote unquote white man's faith is foolishness and a lie. So the point that I'm making is that the embodied experience of some, not all, some of the slaves would have engaged within the Christian faith before they even came to North America. And in that, one has a generational or embodied cultural continuum in the expression. So although the Psalter is the transcribed or notated songs of the Hebrew children as recorded and or remembered, the spirituals in many ways a parallel existence to this diasporic population who continue to remain in exile, right? So there's a deep and definitive connection that we can certainly expound upon, but they are very similar in context.
Let's see, how does the piece Lift Every Voice and Sing fit into this project?
You're not writing a book on this right now, so I'm see if I can do it really quick. Lift Every Voice and Sing was originally written as a recitation in 1899 by James Weldon Johnson. Now, James Weldon Johnson was a huge collector of spirituals, but Lift Every Voice and Sing is not a spiritual. It was originally a recitation for middle school, for 500 middle school children at the Stanton School, which is a all Black middle school in Jacksonville, Florida, on the celebration of Abraham Lincoln in 1900. Now, it was interesting about that here in 2022, we think much different about Abraham Lincoln than we did in 1899, 1900, for obvious reasons, if you read his writing. But James Weldon Johnson's brother, John Rosamond Johnson, wrote the melodic accompaniment. And this is a very difficult song to sing. I don't know if you've sang it before, but the octaves are strange. The dissonance in it is strange. And this song was written for 500 middle school children. Point being is that back in that day, we did not shelter our children from the reality of the pain and oppression of racism, discrimination, and racial trauma. So that first verse is kind of an aspirational hope, right? Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmony of liberty, right? And it's not lift every Black voice and sing, it's lift every voice and sing, right? And then that second verse goes into the tragedy and trauma, right? God of our weary years, God of our silent tears, right? And it goes on. And that third verse is a prayer. And see, the challenge of this is that we still are not contextualizing these songs, because if we understood that, I'm not sure if it was the appropriate response to the Black Lives Matter cry after the murder of George Floyd, when the NFL wanted to sing, lift every voice and sing side by side with Star Spangled Banner, which the third verse of that song is actually extremely racist, which is part of the reason we only sing the first verse of Star Spangled Banner, right? So again, the miscontextualization of these things, of trying to do optics, trying to do quote unquote, the quick and easy fix. So the lift every voice and sing is not a spiritual. In many ways, it could be conceived as a hymn, but it's not a spiritual.
Thank you. Question for Susan. How do you monetize this? Or whenever you do this a spiritual in your worship, is it done? How frequently do you do it? Is it on a weekly or?
Good question. So when we first started it, I kind of committed to doing it once a month. I mean, no, every single week. We kind of made a big production of kind of letting people know about it and kind of building it up and letting people sort of get kind of familiar with the language and what we were doing. And at this point, I have committed to Hamilton Garrett that we would be using spirituals once a month, at least. And that's honestly, it's hard. I want to do them all the time, but it's, I'm being more restrained about it. And it's, and I think it's overall of an effective way to think. So about once a month. And I will say that literally whatever comes in the plate, and for us, you know, it's been COVID recovery time. So we don't have a full congregation yet, and people have started getting used to not carrying cash. So I think that what we get in the plate and through special donations is less than I hope that we will get later on, but it's been quite a lot. I think at this point we've already raised around $10,000-$15,000. I have to double check because it's all been matched by different funds, and it's, you know, so I'm a little convoluted, but it's between $10,000-$15,000 at this point. So, but I think, you know, your congregation knows themselves, and you know, they have to buy into it on their own time. And it's just kind of, you know, I don't think there has to be quite, you know, it doesn't have to be precise, but it's the action. By the way, you should know that James Weldon Johnson also has some other amazing poems. So I love to quote the O Black and Unnamed Bards, and I just think it speaks like this is how they came to be. So it's a great poem.
We had a question about whether attendees can contact the panelists directly. How do you feel about that? And what would be the appropriate way to contact yourself if people are interested?
I'm fine with that. I will put my email address in the chat. I also have a woman who's working with me right now, Ellen Bruce, who's put her information out there, I think, that is helping me with communication. So either one. I'm pretty good about getting back to everybody, if not, you know, but sometimes I miss things. So
I just put my website in the chat. The only reason I use my website is I have an assistant who helps me with correspondence. I got a lot of things going on, but I would love to be engaged in conversation with any and all folks.
And email is fine. And I look forward to the day when I have an assistant, but
be careful, Adam, be careful.
I was wondering if anybody can speak to the difference between referring to a piece as a Negro spiritual versus an African-American spiritual.
I'd like to chime in and say, I had not heard that before. So I'm glad somebody asked that question, because I'd love to hear what Susan or Dr. Price have to say about that.
Well, I'm sure Dr. Price has plenty to say about that, but from this European descent girl over here, I'll say that I have thought about this so much, I can't even tell you. So African American, it's always, the language is such a challenge, but enslaved people were not Americans, and they were not protected by the Constitution, and neither were they like any longer connected with African soil. So, you know, people that were born on this soil, they, you know, motherless children. African American is, I feel it's not appropriate. I think it's like the soft touch that, like, honestly, most of us kind of prefer. And I myself prefer something softer than Negro spiritual, because it's hard to say, even though I know it is a term. I mean, I use the term respectfully, 100% respectfully. And I there's no question in my mind about that, but, the Negro spiritual, from what I understand, that term is, generally preferred, or at least used commonly, amongst Black communities. And that's what I've heard repeatedly from the Black people that I know. And so that's how I ended up landing on that, because I think it's the closest we can come to something that's sort of, you know, authentic. Love to hear Emmett's.
You know, Brian is on the case. Hey, Brian, good to see you here. I've known Brian for a number of years, and he is always on the case. You know, Dr. Alicia Lola Jones, dear colleague and friend, in her address to the Hemp Society, really touched upon this, and I would encourage all of us to pull up that YouTube clip to really pay attention to that. I think one of the things, and Susan hit it right on the head, and I don't need to recapitulate what she said, but I think one of the challenges that we have is we refuse to be comfortable being uncomfortable, and in that sense, if we're going to face history, then we can't every time, you know, when George Floyd was murdered, many people said, this is not us, this is not America. And on the Black side of town, we were like, yo, man, this is, you know, here we go again. You know, I remember Rodney King getting beat by the four police officers in Los Angeles, where I'm from. And I remember the day that, you know, the verdict, the four police officers, and that was videotaped on old school videotape. That wasn't no cell phone, old school videotape. And it was clear as day, and those four police officers were acquitted. And the next day, many of us launched into burning our own community because of the nihilism. We had lost hope in humanity's ability to lean the moral arc towards justice, as Dr. King would say. And so our inability to be comfortable saying the word Negro, and our inability to be comfortable in singing in dialect the sounds and the expressions that this population of people wanted you to sing, and our desire to edit and to quote unquote correct and to quote unquote whitewash, to make it appealing to our own sensitivities and sensibilities, is an unfortunate crisis, because it robs us of the ability to actually be empathetic to what was going on then and what these beautiful people were expressing. And so I think the challenge here is that we need to be honest with ourselves and grow comfortable being uncomfortable, as part of our nation is banning books, as part of our nation is eradicating the rest of history so that white children don't feel bad about their ancestry. Well, my children have felt bad about their experience in this nation all of their lives, as have I and my parents and my parents' parents. So I'm not sure why we continue to privilege or create a system of supremacy so that some people's feelings are more important than other people's feelings. So that level of fragility, we're going to have to work towards getting rid of that. And that's work, frankly, that I can't do. So I invite you, my dear brothers and sisters, please, let's continue to step forward in a system of courage and move forward so that we don't have to replay this again.
Mm-hmm. I want to just add to that, that, it was a big wake up call to me also, realizing as I got deeper and deeper into this, you know, that because people are uncomfortable singing in the dialect. And I've always, again, it's been another puzzle. That's like, why is that so uncomfortable? You know, people feel like they're mocking, people feel like they're making fun of. And I realized that the discomfort comes from, and it wouldn't be a question. There would be no question about whether or not to use the dialect if there wasn't a feeling of superiority. If you didn't think it was wrong to begin with, if you didn't think your English was better than that English, then there would be no reason to change it. You wouldn't feel the need, period. It implies a sense of superiority.
So I have a question here. How does one take into consideration and address information fatigue as it relates to these efforts? Are the songs contextualized the same way each time they are played or sung?
What do you mean contextualized? I guess when we use them in worship, we just use them. We sing them, and I put the pledge in. We don't talk about it more than that. I think we all try to do is to make music as authentically as possible and make it from the heart and soul and not an imitation. So I don't know that you have to go into extreme detail, but you could, you know.
I liked, Susan, your point earlier too about, you know, the long game, and as far as your kind of discernment process and trying to figure out what would be the best way forward without everyone burning out. And to remember, I mean, this was told to me, and I found it very helpful that, you know, it took us 400 years to get to this place, and it's not going to change overnight, right? That this is. It's our job to just push this forward, you know? And I think sometimes maybe it's a human condition, maybe it's a white condition that we feel like we got to fix it. Well, this problem, you know, yes, we got to do that work, but it's not going to be fixed in a year, even if we do everything perfectly, right? This is a process that is going to continue for years and years and years. So kind of to Susan, your thing earlier, just go and do it. You know, I mean, that's kind of the thing. Like, don't get all kind of wrapped up in what success looks like and what the end goal is. It's just start, because realize we will never get to the end goal. You know, it's an aspirational thing, but in our lifetimes, I'd like to think we could, but there's so much that has brought us to this place. You know, it would be foolish to think that, oh, you know, in a year, in 5 years, everything will be better. You know, we've got generations upon generations of things to unwind.
And it's not been that long since we haven't been free of this. And, you know, I mean, honestly, you know, legalized slavery has only been over 150 years. It's not been that long. And you know, according to some people, or you know, and I don't doubt it, there are still instances of slavery still going on today, right? In the traditional form, not, I mean, in the form we're talking about, in places in deep Mississippi and such. So it's right. Terrifying.
Yes, and it's not as though that this minute slavery ended, black people in this country were suddenly treated fairly, you know. It's like it's the 150 years after slavery that we've got to deal with too. And yeah.
Let's also parse this, because the Emancipation Proclamation didn't reach Texas, right? So The celebration of Juneteenth, or commemoration or memorialization of Juneteenth, was the fact that some greedy folks in Texas continue to enslave folks even after. So the point that I'm making is there is an urgency. There's an absolute urgency because there's a population of people who look like me who have been waiting for people mm-hmm. who don't look like me to get y'all stuff together. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, there's a laissez-faire, we're going to do a little bit and then we're going to take a break and go on vacation. We don't get to go on vacation from feeling the oppressive, you know, knees on our necks and you know, all that kind of stuff. So I would encourage you all to keep on keeping on and get busy. I do want to mm-hmm. comment on one thing, Jim, if I can say this, is that I'm approaching this conversation as one who doesn't have an opinion on whether this should be done or should not be done. I'm just providing commentary from a scholarly and as a musician and perhaps even as a pastor. But there is no consensus on the Black side of town in terms of whether this is a valued, valuable, appreciated, sought after piece. But I'm not sure that any of these local congregations need that. I think you need to do what speaks truth to power based on the mission and vision of your local congregation so that you can believe and affirm within your local congregation that you truly are following Jesus and doing mm-hmm. what God would call God's people to do, which is to love one another. Right. And so I think in that sense, I don't think it's really important whether Black folks, you know, give you applause for it or if Black folks will pat you on the back for that. And I'm not here to do that. I'm just here to applaud you for your courage and to thank you for caring enough to do, quote unquote, something, because a whole lot of somethings need to occur in order, because white supremacy and white supremacist ideology is spread through church. Let's be very clear about this. You know, when the white caped KKK, you know, left their services, they burned crosses on the homes of folks and they lynched people on trees as you know, entertainment. And these folks left the church to do that. And then when they did, they went back to a church. So we have to change what happens in some of these churches. And perhaps here, Jim, I will again, you use the white church. I'm assuming that, you know, we have to do something and mm-hmm. y'all got to do something. So mm-hmm. I'm thankful and grateful for you doing something so that this supremacist ideology does not continue to the next generation. We found some young teenagers who sent bomb threats to HBCUs on the first day of Black History Month. So some of our congregations are moving too slow. So I would mm-hmm. encourage us to see the big picture, the kingdom oriented picture, that God does not love any ethnicity or any ancestral heritage more or less than anyone else. But God is calling God's people to come together and it mm-hmm. has to happen.
Dr. Price, I think that is the perfect ending for the conversation. Thank you so much for sharing that with us at this point. I'm just in awe of being with you and talking through these issues. I'm sure there's going to need to be more conversation. I'm sure there's going to be more action and more commitment as we move forward. But in being mindful of the time, we've reached the hour and a half time period at this point. I do want to mention and thank again the UCCMA for sponsoring this seminar, as also to the J.P. Webster Library for hosting the Zoom. And I hope I can see from the comments that many people got a lot of benefit from this conversation, but I do believe that this is just the beginning of a conversation.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And we need to be able to continue and make its work. But thank you so much for being part of the beginning, and I hope to talk to you again all really soon. Thanks to all who are joining us, and look for some more resources on our uccma.org website in the near future. Thank you all.